The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, Trump pulls the plug on yet another Obama disaster.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
We'll hear from Congressman Mike Gallagher.
That means less money that's going to be going to Shiite militias in Iraq that have recent U.S. blood on their hands.
And New York Times columnist Brett Stevens.
It was always a fool's errand to try to conciliate this regime and hope that they were going to turn a corner.
We'll hear from Iowa Senator Charles Grassley, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
My message to any one of the 9 Supreme Court justices, if you're thinking about quitting this year, do it yesterday.
We'll also get news on the U.S. prisoners released, freed from North Korea.
The world breathed a sigh of relief. The Americans came home.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern and learn more at hughhewitt.com. In less than 24 years, President Donald Trump had a year's worth of powerful news. From Tuesday afternoon to Wednesday morning, the Iran deal was put to sleep. The right Republicans won their primaries in key states, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo secured the release of 3 U.S. hostages held in North Korea. We start with the Iran deal, a disastrous agreement that put billions of dollars into the hands of our enemies. The morning after the big announcement that it was over, I spoke with Congressman Mike Gallagher. To me, the original presidential executive agreement was premised on Iran changing their international behavior. They did change it for the worse, for a lot worse. And in fact, their aggression and their threat now posed to Israel is more than enough justification to exit the deal. But on top of that, they burned the American flag in the Iranian parliament. What kind of a regime does that?
A rogue regime that does not share our interests. I think you pointed out something very important, because there will be future negotiations with Iran in some form. So it's important that we learn the right lessons. And one of the fatal flaws of this agreement that the Obama administration perpetuated was this idea that you could somehow discreetly tackle Iran's nuclear program without addressing or indeed ignoring its malign regional behavior, that you could wall off its support for terrorism or its ballistic missile development and entice them to come to the table to negotiate on its nuclear agreement by effectively surrendering the entire region and allowing them to run rampant over our allies in the region. And then the theory of the Obama team was that you would somehow get the moderates in the administration hooked on cash, and that would moderate their regional behavior in the future. But as you just suggested, which is 100% right, the exact opposite happened. So I actually think the JCPOA was the path to greater regional instability and was pushing us towards conflict or pushing toward conflict between Israel and Iran.
Now that gets to the question at the bottom here, is that are our prospects for peace in the Middle East improved by the exit, or did they trigger Iran into some kind of confrontation? Because they've opened up the bomb shelters on the Golan Heights, and I don't think that's theater. I think it's Netanyahu's moment, and he has got to be prepared, and I think he will do whatever it is necessary to knock Iran back on its heels should it dare to attack Israel on its home soil.
This was the right move for at least a couple reasons. One, it brings us closer with our allies in the region, and the only way I can make sense of the Middle East or give you a plan for a modest amount of stability is to have us working in concert with the Israelis and have us working in concert with the Sunni Arab Gulf states. And right now, the Israelis and the Gulfies share interests because they are united in opposition to Iran. I would also say that the most important thing now for the Trump administration to do is to aggressively enforce the sanctions that they are reimposing so that we can undermine the regime in Tehran. That means less money that's going to be going to Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria. That means less money that's going to be going to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. That means less money that's going to be going to Shiite militias in Iraq that have recent U.S. blood on their hands. So anything we do to take money away from the mullahs and further support our friends in the region, to me, gives us a better chance of stability.
Now, in terms of what do we do if those missiles go off, what is your advice if Iran does anything in that region regarding American support for Netanyahu response?
Well, I think we need to have a joint plan worked out with the Israelis, and I think we need to be in the business of aggressively backing Israel's moves in Syria right now. Now, the challenge going forward is because with money from the JCPOA, by the way, we have allowed Hezbollah, a terrorist proxy of Iran, to stockpile on the order of 250,000 advanced rockets under civilian areas in Lebanon and key parts of Syria. When they strike Israel and Israel is forced to respond, there will indeed be civilian casualties. So that raises the question of the things we need to do to make sure the international community is not condemning Israel for defending its own interests. So there are a lot of discussions that I hope we are having behind the scenes with our intelligence community and our military community. I think we can get the Sunni Arab Gulf states to play a bigger role and a more constructive role in stabilizing Syria. But again, I understand the concern over how Iran is going to react, but I think we need to remember that Iran is weak. They are a third-rate, hobbled revolutionary state with a bankrupt ideology and a restive citizenry that's tired of the mullahs. So companies around the world now get to choose if they want to do business with such a country or if they want access to the U.S. financial system. And our policy now will give the mullahs a choice of either changing their behavior or facing an economic collapse. So we and our allies hold the strong hand here, and we need to have the confidence going forward to roll back Iran's malign influence.
As the deal was officially killed by President Trump, the reaction in Iran was predictable. They acted like patients in an asylum. I spoke with the New York Times columnist Brett Stevens after it was announced that we were withdrawing. The Iranian parliament burned an American flag from the front of the room, to which, and I've just said to everyone, how can you deal with a regime that responds to an action that was predictable and telegraphed, Brett Stevens? I mean, just the Vanguard of the Imam by Ostevar. I've told everyone, just go read it. The IRGC is not a negotiating partner. They're a terrorist organization.
Well, one of the terrible things about the Iran deal is that we turbocharged Iran's regional aggression. I mean, people listening to the show should ask themselves, since we agreed to the so-called JCPOA in 2015, is Iran a more moderate country or a less moderate country? Have they been behaving better in Syria? Just earlier, there were what appeared to be Houthi missiles fired directly at Riyadh. Those missiles are really courtesy of the IRGC. I can understand why the Iranians might be mad that they will no longer be the beneficiary of the kind of funding that they previously enjoyed under the terms of the deal, but it's a reminder of how it was always a fool's errand to try to conciliate this regime and hope that they were going to turn a corner.
Okay, now, when the president announced this, he also stressed that he was fulfilling a campaign promise. There was a lot of pushback that this would break America's credibility in the world. What do you say to that, Brett Stevens?
I think that's a joke. And, you know, the people in the Obama administration who are pushing this line, I think, owe America an explanation. Look, the Iran deal was never a treaty, okay, because the Obama administration knew it could never get the consent of two-thirds of the Senate. At the time that it quote, passed the Senate, it had the approval of only 21% of Americans against 49% who disapproved. It passed on the strength of a Democratic filibuster of 42 Democrats against a bipartisan majority opposition. And now we're being told that somehow a document which was never a signed document has no legal force, is a purely political instrument. It's not even an executive agreement, is a testament to American credibility. I think the credibility here was Donald Trump's. As you said, he campaigned saying this was a terrible deal. He gave negotiators a year and a half to come up with something better. The Iranians said no, and he fulfilled his promise. So I would say this is more a tribute to credibility than a violation of it.
Let's turn to Israel. I wrote a piece for the Washington Post called The Netanyahu Moment, because it seems to me this is not theater when they're opening up the bomb shelters on the Golan Heights. I talked to a senior Israeli yesterday, senior member of the government, that in fact they are worried of Iran flying missiles, maybe from Syria, maybe even an intermediate range missile from Iran. Are you?
I am. I mean, I think that Israel and Iran have been sliding toward war for at least the past year. By the way, this is another consequence of the Iran deal, which is that it led to the further entrenchment of Iran in Israel's backyard in Syria, which is something the Israelis were never going to tolerate. So if a war does break out in the next few days, nobody should say it's on account of what Donald Trump did. This has been going on for some time. But look, one thing I do know about the Iranians is they're smart and they're calculating. And they know that when they trace the pattern of escalation, that they are not going to win. Israel has options against Iran that fortunately Iran doesn't have. And that means that if Iran were to attack a crucial Israeli installation, Israel could strike back in a way that Iran could not endure.
Every president understands when the opposing party takes control of the executive office, things will change. The easiest things to alter are those done by executive order from the previous administration. Unfortunately for President Obama, the work done by executive action was part of his legacy. And the Iran deal was just the latest piece to come down. President Obama complained the pullout was a serious mistake, and he accused President Trump of being so misguided. Salem host Michael Medved looks at the former president's reaction.
There's a piece by Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute that appeared today in the Washington Examiner, and it's good. And it indicates why this decision was happening. And Rubin is somebody who actually wrote a useful book about the behavior of dictatorships. It's called Dancing with the Devil. And it talks specifically about how you deal with and negotiate with and try to cope with dishonest authoritarian regimes. And that's something that, frankly, I don't think that President Obama did particularly well. But the real point is, okay, we had an agreement. Iran has had some time to live up to it. Iran's role in the larger world and its role in continuing to develop its ballistic missile program to deliver missiles against its neighbors. And here's the point that I strongly, strongly suspect. President Obama has an entire staff that is paid for by taxpayers. And that's wrong. I don't think we should pay former presidents to maintain their staff. Security is one thing. But if President Obama is being paid by the taxpayer to attack his successor, that's a bad thing. And it's precisely why better former presidents, like everybody except Jimmy Carter, has observed the idea. You did not hear. I mean, George Herbert Walker Bush was beaten by Bill Clinton. He never attacked him. In fact, they raised money together to rescue Haiti in times of difficulty, and they became friends, which is kind of an American way of doing it. And President George W. Bush was nothing if not deeply respectful and supportive of President Obama. When it comes to maintaining his Facebook account, who's paying for the staff that is helping Barack Obama with that? It's a reasonable question. And if it is the U.S. taxpayer, he's not elected to anything right now.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
I've pleaded with McConnell to work nights and weekends and put the pressure on the Democrats. Otherwise, all the hard work I'm doing in committee is for naught.
Iowa Senator Charles Grassley on the Judiciary Committee and the work it is doing when the town hall returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. During the week, a judge for whom no blue slip had been returned, the Democrats in Oregon did not want him to move forward, got in fact a hearing. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, joined me to explain what is going on in that committee and how wonderful the results indeed are. You and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell are the hardest working senators there. And I want to go through the Judiciary Committee record. Congratulations on it. I am genuinely impressed. Are you prepping for a Supreme Court vacancy this summer, Chairman Grassley?
It doesn't do any good to prep for that stuff. I just hope that if there is going to be a nominee, I hope it's now or within 2 or 3 weeks, because we've got to get this done before the election. And there's generally about 50, 60, 70 days between the time a president nominates somebody and we get a hearing in committee, and then another 2 weeks before it gets to the floor. And this has to be done before the November election. So my message to any one of the nine Supreme Court justices, if you're thinking about quitting this year, do it yesterday.
Okay, received. Let me talk about the record for my audience. One Supreme Court justice nominated confirmed. 16 appeals court judges have been confirmed by your committee and the whole Senate. An additional 14 have been nominated. 12 are awaiting nominees. 17 district court judges have been confirmed. 63 are nominated. Lots more vacancies there. Now, to compare that overall, in two terms, Bill Clinton had 62 appeals court judges. You've already done 16. President Obama had 49 over two terms. W had 61. You've already done 16. Of those 14 that have been nominated, how many of those 14 do you expect will get votes by the election?
Oh, I think all of them, if they're circuit court nominees. What I'm afraid of, we won't get the district court people done. There's about 30 district court people on the agenda right now, and I've pleaded with McConnell to work nights, to work Saturdays and weekends, and put the pressure on the Democrats, and we got to have every Republican round, and even cancel a recess so we can clear the calendar of these important nominees. Otherwise, all the hard work I'm doing in committee is for naught.
I agree. I would go around the clock too on this. Now, There are additional 12 vacancies on the circuits. This is what concerns me the more. Supreme Court first, then the circuits. Do you expect that you will get a nominee for every vacancy in the circuit soon?
Listen, I have conversation fairly regularly with Don McGahn, and my staff has conversations with his staff on a regular basis. So we're telling people that we're going to process them just as fast as they get them up here. During January and February, we didn't have enough to process, and I'll give you our goal. Our goal is five district judges and at least one circuit judge and possibly two every other Wednesday between now and Christmas.
That is terrific.
Just as soon as they get them up here, we'll process them.
Now, let me ask you about the district court. This is almost a theological question, Chairman Grassley, an important one. If we maintain the blue slip tradition for district courts, my old state of California will never get another district court judge except under a Democratic president. Is that fair? I mean, we have 10 vacancies on the district court level in California. Is there not some way to split them between Republicans and Democrats so we can at least fill up the litigants are being mishandled because of vacancies?
Yeah. Well, that is up to the White House and what they can work out. I surely suggest those sorts of things, and it works in other states. We have seen that accommodation in Indiana, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Hawaii, Ninth Circuit judge in Hawaii. The two senators returned to blue slip.
Yes, they did.
The nominee is satisfactory to the senators from, and also satisfactory to the White House.
How important is it, Senator Grassley, that the Republican majority remain in place vis-a-vis the courts and the Supreme Court especially, and this goes to every election in every state in November? How important is it that you keep the gavel next year?
Well, it's this important. If we have a Democrat Senate, you're never going to get the kind of people that are strict constructionists that Don McGahn's getting up to us, and you're going to have people not like, we'll say, a little more like Kennedy if you want to pick somebody out of the Supreme Court. That's the kind of people we're going to have on the circuit court.
And now to the third part of these amazing 24 hours of the Trump administration. After all the early talk of Trump rushing us toward a war with North Korea, daylight has emerged. Leaders of North and South met and shook hands. A meeting has been set up between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. And then three hostages were released into the care of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Salem host Mike Gallagher celebrated the news.
And I want to share the statement that the three freed prisoners, the three Americans, gave to the world after President Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo secured their release from a so far cooperative Kim Jong-un, a guy who, you know, we have to all stipulate cannot be trusted. We cannot get too ecstatic over what he's up to. He's can be erratic. He's deadly. He's dangerous. He's mean. He's ruthless. And yet, this president has managed to secure the release of three American hostages without giving away terrorists into the world, without billions of dollars of cash. Just tough, strong, focused attention on maximum pressure, economic and diplomatic pressure that the North Koreans submitted to. I want to read the statement. I just want you to hear the statement from these three men. Watching a beaming Mike Pompeo greet these men at the bottom of the staircase of their plane. I mean, he was just beaming from ear to ear, hugging these men warmly. And the president and the first lady and the vice president there, the cheers, the euphoria. And the world breathed a sigh of relief. The Americans came home. You just cannot take anything away from this administration and what it accomplished. Here's their statement. We thank God. We thank God, first and foremost. We thank God and all our families and friends who prayed for us and for our return. God bless America, the greatest nation in the world. That's what these three men, Kim Dong-chul, Kim Hak-song, and Tony Kim, who walked on their own. They appear to be healthy. One of the men answered a question about how they were treated by the North Koreans. He said it was varying degrees. They were treated okay. They had to do hard labor. He said, when I got sick, they medically treated me. They're alive. They're home. And wow. You know, we have these moments that are immortalized. Think about Bo Bergdahl. Think about getting him back, a traitor, a guy, a deserter. And we traded some of the worst terror leaders in exchange for his return. What did President Trump trade for these three Korean Americans to come home? You know what he traded? He traded the understanding with Kim Jong-un that we're not messing around. That you don't even think about threatening the United States of America.
Your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect not only your family, but generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com, and to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. Go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
We used to have a problem where there weren't enough jobs, where there were people who were worried, I cannot find work. Right now, there is the opposite difficulty. There aren't enough people to fill those jobs.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. With all the good news we received this week, the death of the Iran deal, the hostages released, and the Tuesday primary results, another bit of good news was lost in the shuffle. The economy is smoking right now. During the week, it was announced that the federal government received a record tax haul for the month of April. That's what happens when you cut taxes and drive up incentives. In fact, there's so much employment in the United States right now, a new problem has emerged. My friend Michael Medved explains.
One of the problems that you see all across the country right now, and there are a couple of stories that highlight it, is that we used to have a problem where there weren't enough jobs, where there were people who were worried, I cannot find work. Right now, there is the opposite difficulty. There aren't enough people to fill those jobs. So what does that mean? It means that as you adjust to changes in circumstances, it's appropriate to talk perhaps in different terms regarding policy. There's a piece that is utterly eye-opening at the Wall Street Journal. And it asks the question, how bad is the labor shortage? Cities will pay you to move there. And it's an astonishing story. They focus on the city of Hamilton, Ohio. Now, I've been all over Ohio. I have not been to Hamilton. But Hamilton is an industrial town that it's making something of a comeback, like a lot of other similar towns. It's on the Great Miami River. And they say the jobs of the paper mills and safe manufacturers on this stretch of the Great Miami River mostly dried up by the early 2000s. leaving behind closed factories and an abandoned downtown. But today, a spruced-up waterfront, loft apartments, and help-wanted signs give the appearance of economic renewal. All that's missing is one thing, workers. And that's prompted a novel experiment. Listen to this. If you want to move to Hamilton, Ohio, and I looked up, looks like a nice town. The city promises $5,000 to help you pay off your student loans. Now, obviously what they're doing is they're saying the kind of people we want are people who have student loans or people who usually have college degrees. What they're saying, you come to Hamilton, we'll help you pay off your student loans, a $5,000 bonus to move in. Plus, there are help wanted signs everywhere. People want you to come to work there. Would it be worth it to maybe not have everybody go to Boston and San Francisco and Seattle and have people come to towns like Hamilton, Ohio? Isn't this worth keeping in mind? In this new phase of the U.S. economy, writes the Wall Street Journal, one marked by a shortage of workers rather than a shortage of jobs, civic leaders all around the country are asking themselves, why not pay people to move here? Because that becomes a real challenge for the local economy. Okay, this is an amazing development. There's an economist at the University of California at Berkeley who says the mere fact that they're doing what they're doing highlights the headwinds that smaller towns are facing. There's no one in San Francisco trying to pay people to move here. There's an economist at University of South Dakota who says these financial incentives to move to often Midwestern cities, smaller cities and small towns, it's a modern day Homestead Act. What was a Homestead Act? The Homestead Act was one of the great achievements of President Lincoln. It was that idea that to get people to come out to the West, to settle in places, to deal with those winters in the North Dakota prairie, or to deal with the difficult floods and the typhoon and the tornadoes and the rest of it, you offer them free land. If you're going to come out to some land, the government is going to give you free land, and that's the idea. And the point being that this stuff about helping some of these cities that are making an economic comeback, that now have jobs and have economic activity, you keep it going by getting people to move there. Is there anybody who would not, listening to me now, who would not consider leaving the big town that you're in? With the expense of real estate and all the problems of big cities, to go to a more medium-sized city, maybe someplace that isn't on the coasts, maybe even someplace that is a bit more conservative. The 3.9% U.S. unemployment rate is at a 17-year low. Federal Reserve officials forecast 3.6% by next year. That would be the lowest unemployment in half a century. Small business ranks labor shortages as the biggest concern. Not credit, not rising prices, not rising interest rates, labor shortages.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, the left goes ballistic over an American girl wearing a Chinese-style dress to her prom.
They make up sins. They make them up. It's an amazing thing.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. It's prom season. Kids and parents are posting pictures of the outfits on social media. Lots of smiling faces, beautiful dresses, bow ties, kids having fun. But one young lady posted innocent pictures of her dress, and she had no idea the storm it would create. Dennis Prager explains.
This is under the heading of Even I Can't Believe It. National Review reports that how a pretty prom dress helped reveal rot in the American soul. David French, good guy, wrote about it. Kezia Daum and the insidiousness of the online cultural appropriation police. This cultural appropriation idea is another leftist idea, which is baseless, nonsense, stupid, immoral, that when an Anglo cooks Mexican food, they're engaging in cultural appropriation. They make up sins. They make them up. It's an amazing thing. But if you own the media and you own academia, by golly, you can say the earth is flat. This is equivalent to the earth is flat. If a non-Jew eats matzah, is that cultural appropriation? I guess so. This is what David French writes. I'm going to tell you perhaps the dumbest story you've ever heard, a story that is stupid with a heaping help of malice. On Sunday morning, a teenage girl named Kezia Daum, K-E-Z-I-A-H, posted pictures taken on her prom night to Twitter. Daum isn't a public figure. She's a student at a Utah high school. Her message simply said, prom, and it had four pictures. So I see her with, I guess, her prom date. I see two pictures of her alone and two pictures of her with fellow students, boys and girls, at the in their prom dress. Okay. If you're a normal human being, like the majority of Americans who saw the Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter feeds fill up with prom pictures last weekend, you thought that was a pretty girl in a pretty dress, nothing more. But if you're a toxic social justice warrior, you saw something else. You saw oppression. You saw exploitation. You saw bigotry. You saw, gasp, cultural appropriation. The dress, you see, had obvious Asian influences, and Daum isn't Asian. And I read to you from a tweet sent out by a Jeremy La, L-A. My culture is not, capital N-O-T, your prom dress. We've sunk, baby. Note the likes. 179,000 likes to that tweet. My cultural is not your prom dress. Jeremy Law. Note the comments. That's a monstrously viral tweet, especially for a person with a mere 1,818 followers. It sparked so much attention and controversy that Twitter then created one of its, quote, moments to chronicle the controversy and chart the most salient responses. Daum, to her immense credit, has weathered the shame storm without backing down. She says she simply bought the dress because she thought it was beautiful. What do you think of that, huh? And she admired the beauty of the culture. So that's the story. Here's why it matters. It's indicative of how the people who care the most about identity and oppression are seized by rage and unreason. And because cultures are shaped and defined by those who care the most, Daum's story is not just a Twitter story, it's increasingly the American story. And then he talks about the cultural appropriation issue. It's absurd down to its very definition. I gave you the wrong name. It's Jeremy Lamb who put out this tweet in the National Review website. His tweet comes out with a bird, the Tweety bird, over the M. So I saw it as La, and I thought it was an Asian name. It's Jeremy Lamb. Anyway, this is typical of the left. There is an It's endless. You have to understand, this is so important to understanding the left. There's endless complaints. Endless. They make up stuff. Endless. Cultural, endless is key. That's the essence. It never ceases. They're bored, they're soulless, and they're foolish. And their emptiness is filled by fighting things that need not be fought. They fight make-believe. They're children. They're still fighting make-believe monsters. Cultural appropriation is a make-believe monster. It is one of the most beautiful things on earth when the Japanese play Bach. Does this fool and the 179,000 fools who liked his foolish tweet, what do they think when the Japanese play Bach?
How about baseball?
Or baseball. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Exactly. That's as well, but they're equally obvious. There should be no non-European orchestras playing Beethoven. Right? You idiots. You fools. And it's depressing that there were so many likes. This shows you how effective the brainwash of the left is on the infantile minds that attend their schools. This is one of the most obvious proofs there is. It is not possible to think clearly and to be mature and believe that in cultural appropriation, that it is a moral problem. Girl wears an Asian style prom dress, and she's attacked for cultural appropriation, and this lost soul named Jeremy Lamb gets 179,000 tweets. Now, he's thrilled with it. He loves it. You should see. He's so filled with himself, and he thinks this is legitimate. This is amazing. You have to understand, leftists believe in leftism like Christians believe in Christianity. There is no less depth of belief. Christ is to a Christian what leftism is to a leftist. Why is it beautiful when a Japanese orchestra plays Beethoven? What would he answer that? Oh God. This is truly, if this is not a smoking gun to you about what the left is doing to young minds, there will not be one.
For the entire Prager segment on this topic, go to townhallreview.com. Your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect not only your family, but generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com, and to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. Go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
They claim people to be secretly homosexual who never were. Like Lincoln. Lincoln was not gay.
More schools are force-fed new history. The final segment of Town Hall Review in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Last year, the state of California passed a law requiring a reworking of textbooks to include a significant narrative of the historical contribution of the LGBTQ community. What starts in California rarely stays in California. Here's Michael Medved.
There's a story out of Chicago. It's actually out of Springfield. It's out of Illinois at the state capitol. The state Senate just voted 34-18, which is, it's staggering that this kind of stupidity would be passed by that large a margin, to require all public schools in the state of Illinois to emphasize the history of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people in Illinois. The measure passed yesterday. It mandates elementary and high schools teach a unit studying, quote, the role and contributions of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in the history of this country and this state. School boards would be allowed to determine how much instructional time is spent on the subject. I mean, in Chicago, I'm sure it's going to be half the year. I mean, there's so much to cover. For instance, what? Would somebody please tell me what are they going to study about the history of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people in Illinois? Can you think, will someone please name for me, somebody who was alive before 1950 in Illinois, who was a prominent contributor to the state of Illinois, or the country, who was lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender? I mean, this is insane. And I know they try to claim people retroactively, and it's sickening. They did the same kind of idiot legislation in California. It's a travesty. They claim people to be secretly homosexual who never were, like Lincoln. Lincoln was not gay. There is zero evidence. There was a book that came out, and it came out. There's even some question about whether the historian who wrote the book wanted it to be published. He died before it was published. And it's an absurd book. It's called The Secret World of Abraham Lincoln. But there was no secret world. We know a great deal about Lincoln. The basis for claiming that Lincoln was gay is pathetic. There's even doubts about Walt Whitman, right? I mean, I understand that there is reason to believe, and having read a great deal of Walt Whitman, the great poet, 19th century poet, who, by the way, was a great admirer of Lincoln. Oh, did they have a thing? No, they did not. And there is no evidence, none, zero, zip, nada, of any actual homosexual relationship that Whitman had in his life. This stuff is crazy and wrong. And it's a terrible idea. The fact that it's legislated and mandated by the state. Brian Johnson, the CEO of the LGBT organization Equality Illinois, said last month that the legislation counters the negativity LGBT students receive, not loudly.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Catch up on old episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. Start at our site and subscribe to our Apple Podcast or via Stitcher or SoundCloud or Google Play. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producers Charlie Richard, David Posian, Chanda Chisala, Adam Ramsey, Dwayne Patterson. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the Week in Review program from a perspective you can trust.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.